brought to you by bedroombattlefield.com. This is the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. It's Matthew with you here. And on this episode, I'm joined by YouTuber and Games Workshop historian Jordan Sorcery. I met Jordan last month at Bring Out Your Lead, and you'll hear a wee clip of his first impressions on my recent episode covering that event. But this time around, Jordan was kind enough to come back for a more thorough conversation about his hobby origins, as well as the launch and growth of his YouTube channel. When we initially met at the Foundry, that was on the Saturday morning, so I kicked things off by asking him about what else he got up to during the rest of his time at Boyle.
Yeah, so I was only there for the Saturday because I went on to PeachCon on the Sunday. But for that day at the Foundry, yeah, it was really just, I wasn't booked into any particular games. I was really just there to wander and to soak it up because I'd never been to the Foundry before. So, you know, this sort of crucible of Citadel and Games Workshop history, even though it's, you know, now sort of technically nothing to do with Games Workshop, but just this place that has a really significant role in that history of GW and these games and these worlds that I love. So being able to sort of go and to walk around it, just to be in that space was, even just on its own, really, really cool. And you know, I don't want to sound sort of too, don't want to be over the top, but there was kind of magic to it of just literally being there and being in the sort of carriage court and seeing it and then seeing people playing all of these classic, amazing games that clearly they've spent so much time and invested so much love into, because it's, you know, it is a huge point in the calendar for a lot of gamers and for a lot of people to come together. So it was lovely, just really, really fantastic. It kind of reminded me of that great feeling of old 90s Games Day. You know, so you'd be going to Birmingham for this special day and you were just almost overwhelmed by the scale and the scope of all of the games and the excitement and sort of seeing all of that sort of stuff. So really, really fantastic. And then, of course, you know, the Brian Ansell collection of Citadel miniatures was just, well, something else.
Yeah, totally agree. And I don't think you're exaggerating at all. There is a special feeling about being there, just everything to see and drink in and that. So did you end up rolling any dice at all whilst you were there?
Yeah, I did. I was able to get in on a game of second edition 40K. So a couple of chaps had put together an absolutely stunning board, like properly sort of, it was of the era of second edition. It was an orc fortress, and they the orcs had gone off to do whatever they do when they're not in the fort, and a group of space marines, a tactical squad, had come. They planted a bomb, but then the orcs had returned, so it was this kind of race against time. The orcs are actually assaulting their own fortress and the space marines are trying to escape because the bomb is going to go off after a certain period, a certain number of turns, and it was really, really fun. Just, you know, ultimately quite a simple scenario, really small squads, but it was lovely to be playing that classic 40K. You know, turns out I've forgotten almost every single rule, which was very good that there were a couple of folks who just still have an encyclopedic knowledge of you know, classic system. And actually, just completely randomly and with a touch of luck, the opponent that I was playing against was an old school friend of mine. So we got to actually, you know, relive some of our youth of playing some classic 40K.
So you're talking about like the old games days in the 90s then. I mean, that seems a good opportunity to, you know, you've hinted that you've been to those games days back in the day. So if we go back in time when there's no Jordan Sorcery YouTube channel, like we go back in time to the very start of it all, how does that kind of look for you? When did you first encounter it?
Sure, yeah. So I had the great privilege of having older brothers. So they have, you know, they've influenced a lot of my sort of my hobby life, my interests. So they're massively into films, and that meant that I was massively into films, which also meant my younger brother is massively into films as well. But they also, for their Christmases and birthdays, were getting games that I was then able to play, probably before I should have been playing them, because I didn't really understand them. But so they got HeroQuest, they got Space Crusade, and neither of them really liked those games, but they were in the house. And I used to just set them up. So I had this incredible fascination with HeroQuest of literally just like laying out dungeons, just building dungeons, you know, all of the amazing furniture, all of that, that really cool terrain, putting the models out. And that was kind of it. That was the whole game for me, is just creating the game board and the dungeon, because nobody actually wanted to play with me. So I kind of got joy from just exploring the world and kind of playing with it in that way. But then that kind of primed me, I think, for seeing an actual Games Workshop. So when I was quite young still, we used to wander past the Games Workshop in Chester, it was at the time. And I would see the miniatures on display in the windows and just marvel at them. Didn't really understand it. Again, it was this kind of thing that was just like, what, you know, what is this? What's the nature of this? And there was nobody who I knew who could explain it, you know, these weird miniatures, these weird orcs, these intricately painted models, what do they mean, as it were? You know, what do you use them for? I mean, I remember thinking, and this is probably just pure childish imagination, but I remember thinking that, you know, the actual Games Workshop in Chester was like full of bikers and stuff like that for some reason, which I don't think was really the case. But I think it was that kind of like, you know, that intimidation of a space, because it feels so alien and different, but also really cool and fascinating. I wanted to go in, but I was kind of not brave enough and not old enough, really. And then a number of years later, I was taken into an actual Games Workshop by my mum, into Games Workshop Altrincham, just outside Manchester, and got the opportunity to play Warhammer Quest in a demo game. And that really consolidated it for me. You know, I've been nibbling around the edges, seeing this kind of stuff, playing bits and bobs sort of in my own time. But that's when it kind of became, this is a real thing. This is an actual hobby. There are rules. There are proper games you can play. And from then on, I was just like fully immersed and I was 100% in.
So I take it like, you know, when you had, like, when you were playing around with the HeroQuest and Space Crusade sets, and then you talk about, like, walking past the Games Workshop in Chester, I take it you had linked those together, like, you knew that they were of the same domain, if that makes sense?
I think broadly, yes, but I wouldn't even say for certain that it was like, oh, this is the same thing. Like, I didn't really know what's a Citadel miniature, like, and how is a Citadel miniature different to Games Workshop or MB Games or any of that sort of stuff. So it was kind of this, you know, you kind of know that they're related, but it was almost in the same way as, you know, if you ever walked past those little shops that would have a load of like statues of dragons, you know, like porcelain dragons or these kind of like, I don't know if they're clay or what they're made of, but these kind of like ornate dragon statues, and they'd have other stuff. They'd have like clowns and elephants and whatever. But it was that kind of thing, you know, they were like these expensive collectibles that I didn't necessarily know were actually part of a game.
And then I guess, you know, playing Warhammer Quest, and that is, it's not a like sequel to HeroQuest, but there's a lot of similarities, I guess. So that would have presumably been quite a good on-ramp for you there.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it's not to say that I didn't play the odd game of HeroQuest and Space Crusade and other games like that in the intervening time, but it really became like a legit thing when I played Warhammer Quest. Like it became, okay, this is a hobby now. This is something that you can invest your time in. It's not just not games like Monopoly or Risk even, that come out once a year at Christmas at the family kitchen table. This is something you can do all year round and you can invest yourself in it in the same way as any other hobby, you know, in the same way as being into films or reading or music. There are so many facets to this thing that I can just completely immerse myself in now and, you know, almost lose yourself in it a little bit.
How long was it before you had the opportunity to either buy some miniatures or even a game?
Yeah, that's a really good question, actually. And I don't quite remember the specifics. I'd like to think I pestered my mum an awful lot from that first game of Warhammer Quest. I'd be surprised if I didn't walk out of the store with some miniatures from that, if I hadn't seen any before then. But I certainly, from that point on, all of my pocket money was going on it. I was spending all of my time playing it and trying to convince friends to play it. Over time, I got a really good friendship group, and we would play loads of different stuff. So we would be playing Games Workshop games, but we'd also be folding in all kinds of role-playing games, and things would sort of ebb and flow. So you might be playing more role-playing than you're playing miniatures games, or you might be playing more board games than you're playing role-playing games. But there would kind of be this rotation over the weeks and months of whatever was sort of having its moment in the sun. But we'd basically be playing, a number of times a week, every single weekend, during the week, evenings, all that sort of stuff.
What about painting? How did that fit into your hobby, if at all?
Sure. So I'm notorious, I think, now for not being a big fan of painting. And this is largely self-inflicted. I have never been great at painting. I used to do it a lot more than I do even now. So because it was part of the hobby, you kind of had to do it. If you wanted to play in a Games Workshop store, you had to play with painted miniatures. So it was kind of something that was there. It was part of it. And it was a necessity. And I'll not deny, I absolutely love painted miniatures. I love just poring over heavy metal articles and looking at incredible Golden Demon entries and all this sort of stuff. It's incredible to me to see that stuff. And I really do enjoy it. But I've kind of it's probably... there's some psychological thing, I'm sure, where I know I can't achieve that. So I kind of turned away. I shunned it a little bit. It did the same thing in my youth with playing football. I was never good at it. So therefore, I didn't want to play it. So then I never got better at it. So you're kind of self-defeating. So painting was something I've done and have always done, and I've had painted armies. But it's always been as little effort as possible. And with not an awful lot of skill, a lot of it would be, I guess you'd say, at best, it's kind of table ready, get you by paint schemes without any fancy techniques or any of that kind of stuff. I love dry brushing. That is my favorite thing. And I will try and get away with that as much as possible. But yeah, it's been a part of the hobby, and it's kind of unavoidable. And what's really strange as well is that there are things I've painted where I've been really proud of it and I've put the effort in. And I've kind of been like, oh, that's great. I'm really pleased with that. But that doesn't then make me do it again. I still, when the next project comes up, I'm like, right, how can I do this as quickly and with as least effort and investment as possible?
Yeah. No, that's it. I mean, that's the beauty of the hobby, isn't it? There's so many different facets of it that we don't need to spend time in an area that doesn't particularly interest us if there's areas we get a lot more satisfaction out of. So can you kind of remember your first edition of White Dwarf or that?
No, and I've thought about this an awful lot. So I kind of, so my timelines are all kind of really muddy, and I think part of that is because I very quickly got a little bit obsessed with the stuff from before my time. So I really quickly wanted to get hold of Mighty Empires or Advanced Hero Quest or thing games that had already left the hobby, as it were, that were no longer supported. So I was looking into these older games because something about them spoke to me. As much as I loved the current games at the time, I was also sort of trying to reach back. And part of that was also getting hold of old White Dwarves. I got very lucky at one point when and I don't remember the connection, but a friend of the family or a brother of one of my older brother's partners or someone somehow connected to the family didn't want a big chunk of White Dwarfs that they had. And they just were asking around if anybody wanted them. And obviously I bit their hand off and was like, yes, absolutely. And that was probably 100 issues or something, maybe not that many, but a huge number of issues going back really far that came into my collection quite early. So I was just reading all of this old stuff and really immersing myself in that as well. So yeah, I don't specifically remember my first White Dwarf issue. And it is something I would love to rack my brains and kind of, I hope the memory is in there somewhere. And that hopefully it comes to me one day and I'm like, oh gosh, yeah, that was it. Because yeah, right now I can't recall the specific one.
So what a score though, getting all those white dwarfs, especially, you know, thinking back to that pre-internet era, that was like your gateway into Games Workshop, wasn't it? It was like, oh, you had to kind of see into all these games and see all these brilliant pictures and everything like that.
Oh, mate, yeah, it was genuinely incredible. Like, it, being able to just go back through stuff. And it also, you know, I've always been a collector, I think. So that kind of, like, gave me this huge list of things to try and seek out. And one big part of the hobby for me has always been, has been that collecting aspect. It's been about trying to, you know, close the gaps and find the very niche, very specific thing that, that just fits into the collection. That, and it's not even necessarily about nobody else having it. It's just about me kind of having the whole of a thing. So if that's Mighty Empires, for example, I would scour like secondhand. So there was a newspaper called The Loot, which was just like classified listings that came out every week. So I would be scouring The Loot every week just to see, has anybody got any Games Workshop stuff? Is anyone selling Man of War or Mighty Empires or something? And then I wanted all of the metal pieces. I wanted all of the, every single issue of White Dwarf that had anything about Mighty Empires in. I wanted to make sure that was all in my Mighty Empires collection. So that's always been this way that I approached the hobby of just, you know, and yeah, it's for better and worse. Like a big part of my hobby and in other hobbies as well. I mean, again, in films, in comic books, which I am also a big fan of, collecting and sort of trying to build this perfect collection for any specific like part of the broader hobby has always been something that's that I've invested a lot of time and, you know, at times a lot of money as well in trying to complete those little collections. Yeah, it's really interesting as well, or at least I find it interesting. Like in my head, what becomes this kind of discrete collection? So it kind of, you draw these little boundaries and borders in your mind around what constitutes part of, say, the Mighty Empires collection. You know, would it be, okay, well, it might have to be this issue of the Citadel Journal as well, because that had some additional rules in. But maybe it's not some later thing, because that's not, that, you know, that wasn't from a certain era, so that doesn't count. Yeah, I don't know if that makes sense, but that's always been a thing I did as well.
Did you, have you stuck with, you know, the hobby throughout, or did you have the period that many people have where they kind of dip out of it for a few years?
I did dip out of it. So during my university years, I kind of still kept touch with it. And you know, I had a friend who worked in Games Workshop and friends who were still active in the hobby during that time. So I would often sort of hear the news and the broad strokes, but I wasn't really collecting anything during that period. And I kept some armies, I kept some stuff. When I came out of uni in search of money, I basically had to sell off a lot of my collection, and almost everything was gone by the time I was done, with the exception of a few bits and bobs. That then quickly became something I massively regretted. And as soon as I was financially stable, I was back into collecting stuff again and just rebuying and recollecting the exact same stuff that I'd gotten rid of. So like, it's just complete foolishness, but yeah, one of those needs must kind of situations. But yeah, it was definitely something that I don't think I ever turned my back on, but I was certainly more distant from for a period, which, you know, is kind of natural, I think. You mentioned it, everyone sort of, or a lot of folks tend to do it, which I find really interesting just as a sort of a cultural thing as well, because we all, or a lot of us, come back to it. So like the lore and the love of this thing, like, you know, you're lured in because you really enjoy it, but you kind of maybe put it to one side for external reasons, maybe? I don't know. You know, maybe we think, okay, actually, I shouldn't be doing this. I need to concentrate on something else. I need to invest my time somewhere else. And then actually, it sort of resets when you kind of finally get to a place where you can sort of go, no, you know what? Actually, I do love it. And I'm just going to admit that to myself. And I'm going to admit that to other people. And I'm just going to do it.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Yeah. Can you Can you remember any specific catalyst where, like, you thought, like, okay, I'm going to go and maybe buy some, or I'm just going to take a wander around the Games Workshop? Like, you got any sort of memories there?
I don't know that I can remember a specific thing, though. No, so my Tau army, I kept for a long time. And then ultimately, I got rid of my... So I had a Tau army that I was really proud of that I'd mostly painted. And then at some point, you know, it was kind of one of the final things to go. And I thought, you know what? Like, that's it. I've washed my hands of this hobby now completely in terms of, like, actually having anything. And then for some reason, which I don't recall, I suddenly was like, no, you know what? Actually, that was a mistake. I need to get my Tau back again. And then I invested a load of time and effort into building out. So there was the Forge World Tau models, which were really good. I really liked a lot of those. So I really spent a lot of time on, like, the broadsides that have the underslung rail guns and things like that. Because I just, you know, for whatever reason, they just spoke to me again. And I was like, no, I'm back in. I'm just getting back into it.
Did you know that you could sponsor the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast for as little as $23 an episode? If you've got a game, product, Kickstarter, miniature range, British chain pub or Bee Gees album that you'd like to get in front of an audience of passionate hobbyists, then give me a shout at hello@bedroombattlefields.com. That's hello@bedroombattlefields.com. And now, back to the show. Before we sort of move on to the more modern era, I guess, like you did mention the games days, I guess I should probably ask you about that, like, before moving on. So was that something you attended once or several times, like in Birmingham, was it?
Yeah, it was the Birmingham one. So it was during the mid-90s, so like 95, 96, 97, I think, when it was still at the National Indoor Arena, which was just absolutely awesome. Like, it was such an incredible experience. It's one of those things where I would love to be able to experience it now to see how close my memory is to reality. Because obviously, being quite young or younger at the time, in my head, it's this enormous event with thousands of tables and thousands of people, loads of awesome stuff happening. You know, like, everywhere you look, there's an incredible, specially made, bespoke game table that's kind of been created with its own brand new rules. There's loads of stuff to do, loads of stuff to see, and people to speak to. You know, there I have really, really fond memories of those experiences. You know, that's the kind of perfect, like, hobby memory for me, because it was, you know, you're getting together with a load of people. So you go on the coach from the actual store and you'd be taken along, and everybody was super excited. Everybody had been looking forward to it for the better part of the year. You know, you'd saved up your pennies so that you had a good amount of cash in your pocket so that you could go and spend on whatever the new releases were. It was weird because, you know, you could buy stuff that you would just buy at the store the next week a lot of the time. So you'd see folks who would be like, right, I'm going to buy Space Hulk, and then I'm going to carry Space Hulk around the NIA for the next 6 hours in the most inconvenient bag ever. But it was because it was so exciting. You just couldn't wait to be there and to see all this stuff and get super involved. Like, I remember just, you know, playing, there was a, I think it was Guns of Barak Var was the name of the table. And you had to bring your own cavalry along. And I brought a small unit of Dark Elf Cold One Riders. I think I only had three because I'd only painted three. And they still let me field them. And the idea was that all of the cavalry was on one side, and everybody who brought their own little cavalry units would be on one side, and it was just a perpetual game. So you'd turn up, and the next time it was the cavalry turn, you could just put your unit on and get involved. And on the other side, it was this just enormous array of dwarf cannons of all varieties. And the idea was that you were just charging across the board, and any cannon, any dwarf crew, anything that you killed, you would get to keep. Actually, there was a choice. You could either keep it or you could destroy it. And they had a block of wood at the end of the table and a hammer. and you could just put the cannon on there and just whack it with the hammer and destroy it if you wanted to. And these are all beautifully painted dwarf cannons and, you know, like dwarf crew. And I think I got really super lucky in that there was like a mortar that misfired and all the crew got killed. So that they were firing at me. So I got that. I also managed to take out a regular great cannon, I think it was. And then someone else whose cavalry had taken out a cannon decided to destroy it. So they took it to the end of the table. They smashed it into pieces. And then I just asked them if they wanted the wreckage, the ruins. And they said, no, don't want it. You can have it. So I actually then had like a misfire token for the cannon that I'd won as well. And it was this warped, like totally mashed up cannon chassis. And I was like, that's amazing. That's perfect. So yeah, really, really fun memories from that.
Have you still got that?
No, those, see, that's the kind of thing that I really regret the most, is things like that, that I, at some point I will have just gotten rid of, because for you know, during that period that the money was more important, you know, just for whatever reason. So yeah, a lot of stuff like that is gone, sadly.
So, I mean, looking to, you know, setting up the YouTube channel then, what was the kind of genesis behind that?
So I was doing a job that I didn't particularly enjoy by that point. So I was working in data science and leading a data science team to sort of do analysis and stuff like that, which, you know, it's quite interesting. But as I'm sure anybody who's worked in a sort of major corporate or a bank or financial services or anything like that, they'll probably know that there's a lot of like politics in these kind of businesses. And, you know, you constant change and things being kind of restarted and taken different directions. So I was kind of feeling quite frustrated in my work. And I was looking for a kind of creative outlet and a way to really just indulge in my hobby in a way that I hadn't been doing for a long period of time. So I thought, well, you know, I've seen some really fun channels out there on YouTube, you know, whether that's Snipe and Wib or Arbitrarian and other folks like that doing really cool stuff. Maybe that's something I could do. But I was very conscious that a lot of YouTube in the hobby space tended to be around painting. You know, a lot of it was about it might literally be lessons in painting and how to create and paint stuff, or it might be like aspirational, you know, someone who's gotten hold of one of those classic Thunderhawk gunships and they're going to paint it and then auction it off or whatever, you know, or Titans, huge projects, these dioramas, all this kind of cool stuff, which is really awesome to watch and I enjoy, but that's not something I could ever do or want to do either. So I was looking for a kind of way in that I thought I could add my stamp, my sort of way of adding value to the kind of to the community, and thinking about the, you know, one aspect of the world that I, or the hobby that I really enjoy, being collecting, literally collecting stuff up and understanding the entire history of a thing, you know, whether or not I could bring that, and whether or not I could use some of the skills and techniques that I'd learned in my work, whether that was about, you know, like writing an executive summary or stuff like that, telling a bit of a story of events, trying to bring all of that to YouTube. So that's why my initial videos and you know, some of the stuff that I've probably been more successful with is essentially that it is a story of a collection in a way. You know, so like probably my, you know, I think amongst my first videos was a Warhammer Quest history. What it really was sort of stepping through time, touching on every single thing that was released for Warhammer Quest. You know, it is a primer for somebody who wants to collect all the Warhammer Quest stuff that there's been. So that kind of, you know, that was just a way to bring something I do and that I enjoy, documenting an entire release, like range for a thing that I enjoy. And then kind of turning that into a bit of a story. And I think probably the storytelling aspect has kind of only grown over time, and the kind of the collection list element is maybe less significant now than it was. But early on, it was, okay, I do this in my own time, and that is make a list of everything ever released for Warhammer Quest. I can tell that. I can talk about that.
So I guess, like, for somebody who's not come across your YouTube channel, would you kind of say it's, you know, half maybe historical deep dives into all things Games Workshop, and then the other half, again, on that theme, but like deep dive interviews with folks. Is that a kind of fair summary? Or
yeah, I think that's probably true. I mean, so YouTube's it's an odd platform. It's really interesting to see behind the curtains, or at least I find it interesting. I'm sure most folks do not find the intricacies of how YouTube works to be that interesting. But it was something that I always took an interest in. So I watched a fair bit of YouTube before I started the channel. And one thing that I was always curious about would be like the strategies and the techniques that exist for successful channels. You know, like how are people approaching it? Why do they release it at that time of day instead of some other time? Why do they release it on that day of the week? All of that kind of stuff. Kind of, it intrigued me just generally. So when I started the channel, I was initially just doing, okay, I'm just going to do my little histories and I'm kind of going to sort of play around with everything released for this game or the sort of timeline of this other game or the product from Games Workshop. And then I kind of got lucky and sort of stumbled into doing a couple of interviews with some really interesting folks that then opened the door to, well, this feels relevant. You know, this, if I'm starting to tell the actual development history of these games, not just the release history, not just when was something published, but actually how did it get published in the first place? If I'm starting to tell that story in my videos, actually talking to the people who published it and wrote it and did the art for it, that became a really interesting way of deepening the histories. So the sort of documentary side. So I started to pursue that kind of thing a little bit more aggressively and was like, okay, well, who else is out there who would be willing to talk to me? And you know, how can I make that part of the story as well? I think, you know, one of the reasons I say that YouTube is really strange is that ultimately, because of the way YouTube's algorithms work, it doesn't really like you to do more than one thing on a channel, it seems. So if I was doing, you know, 20 or 30 minute like documentary videos about a product and then an hour and a half interview, YouTube would kind of say, well, these two things are really different. You know, the person who's watching a 20 minute video is not the same person who's watching an hour and a half video. So you kind of get punished in terms of like how it presents that to potential audiences. So I split it off. So I've actually got two separate channels now. One is the kind of histories, the documentary stuff, a little bit of my hobby, a little bit of other games as well, other non-Games Workshop stuff. And then the other channel is like interviews and podcasts and things like that. And the idea there just literally being, well, one channel is where I'll do documentary work and the other channel is where I'll have conversations.
And when was it that the first YouTube channel was launched? Because I think I remember you saying like 3 years ago, which seemed a bit mental.
Yeah, so I think if memory serves, I think it was 2023? It was in November. That might be right. I mean, this is where my own this is what I mean. Like in my head, I'm like, was it 2022 or 2023? I can't remember. I'm actually going to have to check on the channel to confirm which year it was. But yeah, it feels like it's gone really quickly in a way. Because yeah, within like a very short time, it felt like, okay, actually you've been doing this for a couple of years now. I know that I launched the second channel just over a year ago. So that was when I split off and put all of the podcasts and all of the interviews onto that other channel.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like the channel's been around a lot longer. So I was really surprised to hear that it wasn't that long ago, really. So, I mean, how long did it take before you really started to see some serious traction then? Was it a gradual climb, or was there any one sort of like hockey stick moment with your growth?
Sure. So, well, I've just checked, and my first video was Citadel Cats. So it was a history of all of the cat miniatures that Citadel had released over the years. That was on November 1st, 2022. That was really a cynical decision because it meant I got to put my cat Martha onto the thumbnail, which felt like the way to launch a YouTube channel, to be honest. I mean, I think there was... So I would say it was gradual for the most part. I remember, like, the Warhammer Quest videos did quite well. So I then also, at the same time I put the Cats video up, I put the first part of a Warhammer Quest history. And that was like a three-part, I'm going to go through everything with the Warhammer Quest logo on it. And I'm basically going to talk about all the stuff that's ever been released. So that was quite well received, I think. And that definitely helped to sort of relatively quickly grow that initial, like, viewership. It's, in retrospect, it's kind of easy to say, oh, you know, it was quite quick. At the time, it did not feel quick. And there's a lot of, like, inbuilt milestones with YouTube. So in order to monetize a channel, for example, at the time, you needed to have 1,000 subscribers and you needed 4,000 hours of watch time. And getting to that felt like such a slog, like a huge, huge slog, like, a, you know, 4,000 hours. That's a lot. A lot of people have got to come and watch your videos in order to get to that place. So it didn't feel like it was super quick, but I remember folks who I respected and admired and was, you know, had their own channels and who were around, who I was able to talk to. They were sort of saying, oh, you know, you're growing really quickly. This is just really cool to sort of see that. So I think getting to 10,000 subs was relatively quick. It then probably plateaued and slowed down a fair bit. It's now very slow, and a lot of that's to do, again, with, like, how YouTube works and sort of, you know, the intricacies of whether subscriptions even matter anymore on YouTube, which is kind of weird. But I think probably the biggest video I have ever made was about HeroQuest. It was a history of HeroQuest, and that came out, I think I did a Space Crusade one around Christmas, and that did quite well. And I was like, okay, let's do the HeroQuest one. I think it was in that order. And the HeroQuest one has consistently brought in views since then. You know, like, folks love HeroQuest, love hearing the history. I'm quite proud of that video. I mean, there's a lot of technical things that I would go back and improve. You know, the sound quality is not great, I think. But I'm proud of the actual content and the research that went into it. And folks have, you know, have complimented that and sort of said, you know, this is a really good, quite comprehensive view of it, including Stephen Baker, the actual creator of HeroQuest. He's since reached out to me and we had a few conversations. And then he offered to do an interview because he liked that video from way back when. So that HeroQuest history played a huge role in sort of helping to grow the channel and to kind of give me a bit more credibility and all that sort of stuff as well.
How do you kind of handle the, I mean, there's obviously, like, no matter what kind of job you do, if you're running your own business, and I'm speaking as somebody who doesn't run their own business, but there'll be that pressure, you know, there's a lot relying on you, and especially in a job like this, like, how do you kind of handle that pressure of feeling the need to constantly be creating and putting out new content?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's that's a good question. So I kind of was quite lucky coming into it. So I when I left that old corporate job, I was able to leave basically because of how the corporation handled things. They, like, basically paid me to leave, to walk away. So that kind of gave me a bit of cash to sort of have behind me whilst I was able to focus on just creating the platform, creating the channel and the videos and that sort of stuff. That is a huge, huge privilege. And you know, to be in that position, to be able to sort of follow a dream without having the kind of financial pressure at that immediate early point. So I can't say, I can't speak to the experience of someone who is building a channel and building this kind of thing in their spare time and then having to deal with all the sort of financial pressures at the same time. I kind of was, you know, quite lucky in that I was able to, when I decided to do it, I more or less, within a number of months, was able to go full time on it and just say, right, I'm going to give myself a period of time doing this 9 to 5, 5 or 6 or 7 days a week at times, and really invest myself in order to build the channel and kind of build the presence, so that hopefully by the time the money I do have runs out, I will have built a sustainable business. you know, and we're still on that journey. And I don't know that I have got to that point yet, sadly, which, you know, brings with it its own set of stresses. But in terms of just sort of running it as a business, it's super. I find it super interesting because you're doing so many different jobs in order to run a YouTube channel. I don't think I ever really appreciated it before starting it. But essentially, you know, writing and recording and editing YouTube videos, you know, that already is more than one sort of quote unquote job. You know, a lot of different aspects of a sort of creative role in order to do that. But that's only one part, an increasingly small part of the sort of broader work of creating YouTube content. Because you also have to do the thumbnails, and you have to do the social media marketing. And if you want to monetize through, say, a Patreon or a Ko-fi or somewhere else, you need to set that up, and you need to manage and maintain that, and you need to engage with people on that platform as well as on your main platform. Just responding to comments on your main platform can be quite a big piece of work. And then you're still looking at trying to create new videos and new content. Think about where do you go next in terms of the stories you want to tell or the videos you want to make. So there's a lot of hats and lots of sort of different things you can spend your time doing. There's a YouTuber, D&D YouTuber called Ginny D, who's done a great video about it that I kind of took a lot of lessons from early on. But she's talked about it in terms of, like, there's literally always something you could be doing with your time. There will always be another job that you could spend time on. And if you're not disciplined, you will find yourself like going down these weird little alleyways and spending time on something that you don't necessarily need to spend time on. So there's a lot of prioritization and sort of trying to optimize your time, not get too carried away. It's a tough balance because as much as it being a business, you also want it to remain fun and interesting, which, again, I'm super lucky in that I do find both the business and the creative aspects to be really interesting. So I quite enjoy a lot of what I do, a lot of the work involved in running this thing. But like, so I've recently done this Warhammer Film Club podcast where like I've brought guests in from other YouTube channels, other content creators. We watch a couple of movies that have a sort of broad relationship with Warhammer history, and then we talk about them, you know, and that's the nature of the podcast. Actually recording the podcasts, you know, I did 6 episodes, 6 guests. That was like the smallest part of that project to put together, because you then have to go, okay, well, now I need to do all of the thumbnails. I need to do all of the editing. I need to upload it onto YouTube, but also onto all of the different podcast platforms. I need all of the sort of like Patreon support. So, you know, there is a like outtakes, and I do an article, like a blog post that kind of goes into more detail about the connections between the film and Warhammer history, and kind of has specific citations and quotes and bits of interviews with Rick Priestley or whomever. All of that kind of stuff actually takes more time than recording the podcast. And you could, yeah, I'm sure there'll be folks who are sort of saying, well, those are all kind of nice to do. Just doing the podcast itself is probably the most important thing. And that, you know, that is true. But if you're trying to run it as a business and trying to make it into a sustainable, like productive thing, all of that extra stuff takes on a new level of importance because you need it. Because, you know, as much as it is creative content and it is an expression of like love for a hobby and love for films and great conversations, it's also a product. So you need to package it as a product. You need to have all of the associated things that go with that, the branding and the advertising, the marketing and that kind of stuff. So yeah, it is. It's super interesting. Whether or not I actually handle the stresses and strains of it very well, I couldn't tell you. I'm sure my partner could tell you better whether or not I do a good job of it. But I do think that the corporate roles that I've had in the past, you know, because they were in a sort of very traditional corporate environment, a lot of the techniques and the tools that I learned in those roles have played a really important part in this one, which I often reflect on and kind of find really fascinating, because everything from like learning how to present and how to work with you know, to present in front of audiences live, whether or not it's that, or the way in which I write, the way in which I research and document stuff, the way in which I create the sort of the visual content for Patreon, for example, or that kind of stuff. All of those skills have direct ties back to the work I was doing in my previous career. And then on the creative side, I actually studied film and time-based media, the course was called back in the day. And that was a lot around editing and, you know, how to create video content. That was probably not my most successful hour at university doing that course. But it turns out that actually it was really helpful, again, for this particular job, you know, this kind of working on YouTube, creating YouTube content. So I kind of feel quite lucky in that almost by accident, these very different experiences that I had in my academic like career and then my professional career has all kind of led me to this one that I'm doing right now and that I love and that I very much want to continue doing if people, you know, want me to, essentially.
Yes, yeah, it's really interesting to hear that, you know, the kind of behind the scenes stuff. And I mean, you've talked there about this kind of 9-to-5 approach. And even if you don't mean that literally, you know, if we think about a kind of cutoff period where, say, it was 5 p.m., like, okay, no more work for me. But I guess the issue there is it's your hobby. So does it count as work if you then go and play a game of second edition? Like, you know, how easy is it if I could speak, is it to turn off the kind of work hat and just say, I'm just going to have a game here and, you know, not even think about creating content around it? Or is that just something that you would enjoy so much that you totally don't mind?
So I think I'm, again, quite lucky in that I kind of don't mind things overlapping quite a lot. So again, you know, I think one thing that you hear quite a lot around, you know, if you make your hobby into your work, it will stop being a hobby and you're not going to enjoy it in the same way. And I totally have sympathy for that. And I think that that is true. However, I think I also enjoy whatever this third thing is that it's become. So it's not quite a hobby. It's not quite work. It's something else in the middle that's both and its own thing at the same time. So I quite like having this extra like element to whatever it is I'm doing. If I'm like, okay, I'm going to read that book because I quite fancy reading that book, but that could also be a book review that I'll put out, or it might also be part of a season of content I'm going to do somewhere. Similarly, you know, with this film club, there were a load of films that I watched because I kind of always wanted to watch them. It was a good excuse to kind of get me to do that. And I enjoy doing it. And it also serves a purpose like for my work. So I'm quite pleased about that. One thing I probably don't do nearly enough is sort of actually get to the table for games. So I do a lot of role play and stuff like that because it's easy to do that remotely. It's a lot harder to, you know, obviously remotely play miniature games. I know there are tools for that, but I've kind of not got that kind of infrastructure built with friends who do it. So I tend to play less frequently, but they're kind of, you know, more special games because you get friends together and you go somewhere and you kind of do it. That's something for next year that I want to try and change. I want to play more frequently again, you know, get back to those times when you'd be able to get together for a game and play something quickly, play something locally. So I definitely probably don't do enough of that. But when it comes to everything else, you know, just reading an army's book or a codex, it's serving multiple purposes, which is actually sort of, I don't know, it kind of does something in my brain where I'm like, oh, fantastic, I've ticked two boxes by doing this. One is just like the pleasure box of this was a fun thing for me to do. And the other one is, oh, it's a productivity box because I'm going to now be able to, you know, use that knowledge in a video or in some research, or it ties to this or ties to that. So it kind of, for the way my brain works, again, I think it's probably tied to this collecting thing. So I like to, you know, I used to read an awful lot of fiction, but I would kind of like, you know, if I can use these terms, I'd kind of be like collecting authors. So if I was like, I'd get really into, I don't know, H.G. Wells or Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and I'd be like, right, I want to read everything they've done and I want to tick off all of their stuff and kind of collect in my head those stories and be able to cross them off the list and be like, right, they're done. collected that now, I can move on to something else. So there's this kind of like weird thing in my mind where I'm like, okay, well, when I'm collecting these things, I'm collecting it for a different purpose. I'm collecting this book because I want to read the entire Gotrek and Felix saga, but I'm also collecting this book because I might do a GW book club episode about it and that kind of thing. It's sort of, yeah, I don't know. My brain's got a weird box ticking obsession, I think. So if I can find ways, I get pleasure from ticking off the boxes. So if those boxes are doing many things, that's great.
If you were getting the opportunity to actually get to the table and play regularly, what would be the kind of three or four games or additions that would kind of make up your stable?
So I have been building, it's been a bit on hiatus lately, but I've been building a Warhammer fantasy army for the old world, ostensibly for the old world, but really my kind of plan behind it was to collect up an army that would have representation from like every era of Citadel. So we'd be going right back to, you know, pre-Slaughter, Puddle bases and have some minis from that era. Every single edition of Warhammer Fantasy, the old world, 40K, Necromunda, and even Age of Sigmar, and try and bring in all of these different models in different ways and try and sort of create, you know, an army that looked cohesive and kind of came together as an effective army in the game, but that you could field in any edition of Warhammer Fantasy, or, you know, you could build a list for every edition of Warhammer Fantasy, but on the table represents the entire history of Citadel Miniatures. You know, not to sound like too grandiose about it, but that was the kind of vision for it. We had to, so that I was kind of making headway with that project. It was so it's a Marienburg army, so that would allow me to have lots of different mercenaries. So that kind of also smooths over some of those, you know, where you might get different styles and sort of, you know, miniatures of different eras that don't quite look, you know, perfect together. Oh, well, it's a mercenary army, so they've kind of all been hired from different parts of the old world to come together and fight. So you can kind of get away with it a little bit more. But I was also sort of trying to tell a story with it as well and sort of, you know, build out a load of lore and a load of other stuff. So that's kind of been my biggest hobby project of late. So the old world as a game system, I want to play a lot more of it. I've played some games, but I want to play a lot more of it over the next year and really get that Marienburg force onto the table a lot. I really like the idea of doing a little campaign, and this is probably far too ambitious, but I really like the idea of sort of refighting key battles from the Storm of Chaos event for Warhammer Fantasy. But I would love to do a different scenario in a different system, like every time. So you literally start from a skirmish in first edition, right the way up to like a major battle in eighth edition by way of, you know, you might have a High Elves versus Norse game of Man of War, and you might play some of the invasion using Mighty Empires. So this is kind of an idea that I've had for a while. I was like, that would be so amazing to kind of organize that and to put something like that together. It's just one of these things that's a huge amount of work. So whether or not that actually ever happens, I don't know. At a minimum, I would love to just play some Storm of Chaos games with a combination of 6th and 7th edition. So I think I would use the base rules for 7th edition, but the army's books from 6th edition would be my sort of ideal plan for next year, is to maybe try and organize some games of Warhammer World, Storm of Chaos themed, at the very minimum, just using the 7th and 6th edition rules. And that's sort of what I would go for, I think.
What's got your attention right now in the hobby? What are you painting, playing, or planning for this month? Head on over to bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail to submit a clip for our monthly hobby update episode. That link again is bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail. And now back to the show. What about like outside of Games Workshop? Like, even if you don't necessarily play indie games, do you have any rule sets for likes of Frostgrave, Hobgoblin? I seen you had Mike on recently on one of your episodes.
Yes, so I've got Hobgoblin, which I really like. I've still not actually gotten it to the table, but I would love to do that and love to get a game in of that at some point. Non-GW games for me. So I play a lot of different role-playing games, and that can be, you know, anything. That might be a Call of Cthulhu or a D&D 5th edition or Wolfrup and you know, the old world RPG that's just come out. So I'll play lots of different RPGs. Miniatures games, for me, tend to be more focused on Games Workshop. So I as well as just, I mean, again, it could be this kind of collecting thing, but like I love Citadel miniatures. Like a big thing for me is that I just really like their models and I like their worlds. So I think if I'm playing a miniatures war game, that kind of is the first place I want to go. That's not to say I wouldn't play other games, but you know, I used to play a bit of like One Page Rules and things like that. I just don't enjoy it as much for whatever reason. You know, it's a good system, it works well, but I just kind of want to be playing Warhammer Fantasy instead, or 40K. You know, it doesn't have to be the current editions. I just tend to prefer that. In terms of like non-miniatures games, I play a lot of different board games as well. So I quite enjoy getting a board game to the table and sort of spending a bit of time on that.
Can you remember the last miniature you bought?
The last miniature I bought would probably have been, let's see if I can see it from where I'm sat. Gosh, yeah. Now this has really tested my memory. Now I think it was, I've got a an old Citadel Trapper. So this is an old C series Trapper who I think looks kind of like a Kislevite character. So I got him for that Marienburg project. So the idea was that I have a load of different era of Citadel miniatures that are representing different like Kislev warriors, and they're led by so I think it's Lady Hera from Necromunda. I think that's right. The daughter of Lord Helmore. So that's a current Necromunda model, but she's kind of got this really, you know, it's kind of this Russian Tsarina kind of look and feel. And I thought that's really cool for Kislev. So she's the captain or the champion of this Kislev unit. And then I wanted to fill out the rest of the unit with just random miniatures from Citadel history that feel like they could be Kislevites. So that's probably the last one I bought. Before that, I also got Rialta Snow, if you're familiar with that character. So she's another classic Citadel miniature from first and second edition, who was a sea elf and was described as being a sea elf traveler. So she's extremely rich, extremely beautiful, incredible archer, is just on a grand tour of the old world, or the known world of Warhammer, just happens to find herself in all of these different scrapes in different places. So she's in Lustria during the Magnificent Sven adventure, and then she happens to be in the old world during the some other stuff as well. So like she gets to turn up in all of these different places. I just think it's a really fun character and I quite like her. And because she's a sea elf, I really like the idea of having a Marienburg unit of sea elves as well. So I got hold of some of the Marauder sea elf miniatures. I would like to get some more of those. And she's going to be the champion for that unit in the Marienburg army. So yeah, lots of that sort of thing is kind of digging around and kind of finding fun, characterful, sort of storied miniatures that speak to me and kind of tell their own story that I can then put into my Marienburg army.
What's coming up on the YouTube channel? I'm aware we're kind of running out of time here. It's been the conversation's flowing, but what could we kind of expect coming down the pipe on YouTube?
Sure, yeah. So, well, I've been looking at, again, the old algorithms being what they are. I've been thinking, right, what's my strategy going to be? And for various reasons, it seems like the final quarter of the year is kind of a really important one where you can, you know, there's more people just watching YouTube during that time. I guess it's colder and rainier outside, so there's more eyes on YouTube, more views available. And then advertisers are also like more interested in buying ad time during that period as well, because it's a run up to Christmas. So actually it's quite an important period for YouTube. So I've kind of been on a little bit of a hiatus and releasing less content recently because I'm working on some like big videos to release during the final months of the year. That's going to be interrupted because I've got Chaos Dwarfs. So a history of Chaos Dwarfs is going to be the next video that comes out to try and align to the release of the Chaos Dwarfs for Age of Sigmar. So that's my Building Warhammer Armies series where I kind of drill into what were the influences on the very first examples of whatever army I'm covering. You know, and in a lot of cases, that might be Tolkien, that might be Robert E. Howard, that might be Michael Moorcock. All of that stuff that then went into the melting pot of early Warhammer that then evolved into something we recognize today as Orcs and Goblins or Elves or, in this case, Chaos Dwarfs. And then how did they actually sort of progress in the Warhammer world over editions? So that's the next video that's coming out. But yeah, I've been working sort of in the back room on some bigger videos for the end of the year. I'm really hoping to do the next video in my long-running Making of Warhammer series. So we finally get to 8th edition, you know, and all of the different things that led to the creation of the 8th edition of the game and how it came out, how it was received, and kind of the story of that 8th edition. And then there's a number of other things that I'm trying to get ready as well, like a Blood Bowl history and Advanced Hero Quest and some other cool stuff like that. So fingers crossed I'm able to actually deliver on all of these things I've been promising myself and others that I was going to make for a long time. But yeah, I really kind of at that point where it's sort of make or break, you know, for the channel. And we want a really strong end of the year so that I can go into 2026 and keep doing this thing that I really love doing and hopefully people are enjoying and sort of want to see more of.
Just wait till this podcast sends its 6 or 7 listeners your way. You'll be sorted.
I will take it, man. Absolutely. Come on over, guys, because, yeah, absolutely, it'll be great.
They'll finally get to stop listening to me. Just a geeky content creator question. I'm curious, and I don't want to keep you much longer, Jordan, but I'm curious just to that dynamic between, like, you've got the audio feed now, and you've obviously, your main thing is doing the video, but you've got that separate where you've been able to put the interviews up in an audio format. Have you saw decent numbers on the audio-only stuff?
So, yeah, the interview podcast has done reasonably well. It's a tough one because, you know, like I don't really advertise it very much. I don't talk about it an awful lot, which is probably something I should do. But again, you know, you've kind of got this long list of things to promote, and I'm sure it fatigues people if you're constantly going, oh, check out this video on YouTube and check out this other video and check out this podcast release. So I kind of don't push the podcast stuff too much, but organically, it's grown reasonably well. I kind of hoped that the Warhammer Film Club podcast would do big numbers because it's, you know, it's broadly interesting, I would hope, to folks. You know, not only is it Warhammer related, but it's also films, which, you know, a lot of people love. We do some real classic films in the podcast. You know, we're talking about Terminator 2 and Starship Troopers and The Thing, films that a lot of people love. And there are far more famous than I am content creators who are the guests on it. So I was kind of thinking, right, that might do quite well on the podcast front. It's done okay, but again, maybe I'm not advertising it and talking about it enough. But yeah, the podcast feeds are worth having, I think, but they are not generating huge numbers and not generating revenue, really. You know, the odd couple of cents here and there when we run an advert on the interviews, for example. But in terms of, like, you know, and I don't want to bore people with all the monetization and stuff, but the sort of the brass tacks of it being you need all of this stuff to sort of pay for itself eventually. On the podcast side, it's not really there yet. You know, fingers crossed we get there one day.
Yeah, again, the 6 or 7 listeners will be heading to the film club podcast. You don't really want the 7th guy. He's not very nice, but take the other 6. So I will, of course, like, put all the links in the show notes as well. I'll catch up with you after we stop and just make sure I've got all the different channels or places you want to promote, anywhere broadly that the listener could go as well, just to check things out.
I mean, I'm Jordan Sorcery on pretty much every platform. So that's the name of my YouTube channel. It's the same on Blue Sky, on Instagram, on Patreon. And then Jordan Sorcery Pods is like the podcast channel on YouTube.
The moment where it clicked, Jordan Sorcery was a play on Sword and Sorcery. It was a chef's kiss moment for me. And I did share that on my own podcast Discord. And a lot of people were like, oh, I didn't realize. So I thought I was like the last person to get it, but evidently not.
I was probably more proud of that than I should be when I came up with it, because there were a lot of conversations I had with my partner about, you know, what's a good name? What's a good name for the channel? Because I was very conscious I wanted it to be like my name, because I didn't want, if it proved successful, and maybe this was kind of hubris early on, but I was like, if this proves successful and this is a job I do for 10 years, I don't want to be introduced as like Hammer Man, you know, or something like that, when you're doing interviews or doing whatever it is in 10 years time. So I was like, I want to be Jordan. Like, that's my name. I want to work that in somehow. So we had all kinds of different permutations of it. And then this is just the one that kind of came to me in a weird moment and kept coming back. I think I dismissed it early on. I was like, nah, it's too silly. But it just kept on coming back to me. I was like, yeah, go on then.
Yeah, no, it's a great name. And that's not exactly high praise coming from the man who runs the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. But again, next
mate,
listeners.
I'll take any praise you got.
Thanks very much for listening to this episode of the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. If you enjoy the show, then please do share it with someone else you think might enjoy it too. And be sure to check out our Discord community of like-minded hobbyists, which you could find at bedroombattlefields.com/Discord. It'd be great to see you in there.